people are starting to see that it's important for everyone in an organization, even entry-level people, to be able to see themselves as responsible, as leaders, as owners. And I completely agree with that. I think in organizations where everyone has that sense of, I'm an important part of this organization and what I do and say is influential, that's positive. And then they need to be treated that way by the organization, or it just becomes demoralizing and loses credibility.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Erica Anderson, the founding partner of Proteus, a coaching, consulting, and training firm that focuses on leader readiness. Erica advises leading executives and companies, including NBC Universal, Facebook, GE, and Hulu. Her work focuses on organizational visioning and strategy, executive coaching and management, and leadership development. If you're looking for guidance on how to become a better leader, this is the episode for you. Erica is the author of multiple books on leadership and the host of the podcast, The Proteus Leader Show. She shares profound insights on self-awareness, changing your self-talk, and the six attributes at the core of all good leaders. Here's our conversation. Well, Erica, thank you for joining me this morning. I'm so excited to have you here in our podcast, and I can't wait for our listener to hear your insight.
Yes, I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah, so I thought it would be interesting for, you know, our listener to hear your experience. I mean, you coach a lot of different leaders and you wrote many books about, you know, being the good leader, how to be strategic. What got you into this world, and why you want to do this kind of work, before we start going into the deep dive about your insight?
All right. So I could go way, way back, but I'll do the abbreviated version. So almost 40 years ago, that may not seem like the abbreviated version, I was given the opportunity to start working in organizations by my first sort of boss/mentor, a guy named Tim Galway, who had written a book called The Inner Game of Tennis. And it was really about how people learn and how they get in the way of their learning. Tennis was just the metaphor. And it became very popular in the late 70s and early 80s. And he hired me to help turn his work into learning programs. And I worked for Tim, and then I worked for another wonderful guy, Peter Block, who wrote some amazing books about consulting and same thing, turning his IP into training programs. And then I worked for another organization as head of training, but I really wanted to, by this time it was the late 80s, I really wanted to start my own business. And what I wanted to focus on was what were called at the time, this is now 30 plus years ago, soft skills, because nobody knew how important they were, you know, management, leadership, teaming. And I wanted to have an organization that supported companies in that way. And more importantly, help them get clear about the future they wanted to create for themselves and then help them achieve that future. And that was when I started Proteus in 1990, that was our mission. And it is still our mission, helping organizations clarify and move toward their hope for future. And so all the things that we have subsequently done, coaching, training, facilitation, consulting, are all in the service of that.
Okay. And so what you're saying about, you know, what you'd like to achieve, your goal, the future, that's where you start with that. And maybe you can help us understand when, say, I'm a client, I'm a leader, I'm a CEO of a company, and how you, and I said, I need to get some coaching. And how would you tell me where to start?
Oh, that's really interesting. So you're assuming that you've come to me and you've already understood that you need a coach. Is that what you're saying? Okay. So then the first thing we would do, and we have a group now of 13 executive coaches, And we've worked with all different kinds of companies. And we have a very specific approach to coaching, which is in some ways pretty unusual and in some ways similar to others. But our focus really, if somebody has decided to engage with a coach, with one of us as a coach, the first thing we do is help you see how you're seen. And we do that by getting from you, the coachee, a list of 6 or 8 people who live kind of around you in a circle who we can talk to, with whom we can have confidential conversations about you and your strengths and growth areas as a leader. And then we create a summary, a very simple 2-page, here are your big strengths, here are your couple of growth areas, report. Because, you know, none of us see ourselves entirely clearly. And it's really helpful for you as a leader, anyone who wants to be coached, to know how they're seen in the environment. We also have a couple of assessments that we do to help that. And so then we go into the coaching engagement where, you know, then we kind of look at the two. So how do you see yourself? How do other people see you? Is it the same? Is it different? Big surprises. Kind of a gap analysis. And then we begin to design the coaching engagement based on that. Based on how can we lean into the strengths that you have and that other people see in you, and how can we address the weaknesses and growth areas that you feel in yourself and that other people see in you. And that becomes the basis of the coaching engagement, which is great because then it's not as kind of transactional, sort of like, what's up this week? It's really fundamentally, how are you great and how are you not so great and how can we help you become even more great?
And when you've done a lot of this assessment, what is the percentage of the person, the leaders, view themselves match with what other people think of themselves?
Oh, that is a great, great question. It's really kind of all over the map. I mean, like a lot of things, you can describe it with a bell curve. I mean, there are probably 10 or 15% where it's just, you know, who I think of as being the most self-aware, who it's a great match. They're like, yep, that's, I see myself this way. And then they hear how other people see them and it's pretty much the same. And then for most people, it's kind of in the middle. There are some things that that are news to them or that they haven't seen themselves clearly. And then there are a few people who just, you're like, wow, you really don't see yourself as other people see you. We got to work on your self-awareness. So it's really all over the map.
Okay, so let's focus on more like the big, the average, yeah. And then the people on the other side, because I think the people who are on that side, they kind of have that self-awareness. And you mentioned about self-awareness, how I assume it must be really important being a leader.
Yes.
And how do you coach somebody who are not self-aware to become self-aware? Is that a trick?
Yes, yes, yes. So it is critically important. And there are a lot of studies over the years that have shown that accurate self-awareness is one really important and pretty accurate predictor of success as a leader. And I think we've all kind of experienced that in our lives. Like we've all had bosses who weren't who they thought they were. And we can see how difficult that is, you know. So the place where we go to help people become more self-aware is, so all of our self-awareness lives in how we talk to ourselves about ourselves, right? So, you know, we all talk to ourselves all the time, right? We all have this continually running internal monologue. Well, a lot of it is about the world or other people, but a lot of it is about ourselves. And people who are self-aware say accurate things to themselves about themselves, and people who aren't say inaccurate things. So one of the things, and I talk about this in my last book, the Be Bad First, the book that's about how to become a great learner. And one of the elements of becoming a great learner is having neutral, accurate self-awareness. So we help people get in touch with, listen to, if you will, what they're saying to themselves about themselves. And then we encourage them to create a habit of saying, is that accurate? And really, it's sort of like, then you turn your, that's a way of turning your conclusions about yourself into a hypothesis. Is that accurate? So rather than saying, I'm terrible at math, you go, am I terrible at math? And then once you've asked yourself, is it accurate? Then the second question is, what evidence do I have or what facts do I have? And that encourages you rather than just to carry these assessments that you have of yourself, which may be based on nothing, it may be completely inaccurate or outdated, to really look at the facts, to become more neutral and more of a fair witness of your own reality, to then become more self-aware. And it works very well.
I think that is, that's interesting, a way of looking at the self-assessment. Then it can help neutralize when you're overconfident or underconfident.
Precisely. It's sort of adaptogenic. You know how some medicines like mushrooms are adaptogenic? If you need to become more of something, it'll make you more if you become less of it. And so I completely agree with you. Questioning your own self-talk in that way is adaptogenic. If you are overly confident, I mean, it's just as likely that somebody goes, I'm great at math, and they're not, you know. So it helps you really come to that accurate middle point. And the great thing about that for a leader or for anyone is that you can really only learn and grow well from a position of neutral self-awareness. If you are not accurate about where you're starting from, then it's hard to grow. It's kind of like if you were to say, okay, I'm in Philadelphia and I need to go to New York, but you're not actually in Philadelphia, you're in London, you know, that ocean's going to be a big shock. Right? So we have to be pretty accurate about where we're starting from in order to learn well, in order to lead well.
And so being an entrepreneur, you know, it takes a lot of confidence because you have to, otherwise, you know, because the journey is really long and can be really hard. And it takes certain type of personality, I think, to keep on going, to believe. And so how do you balance that? And I thought what you're saying, this neutral assessment, it helps everybody to be in check.
Yes. And I think it's even more important for entrepreneurs, because having been an entrepreneur myself and having, you know, dealt with many hundreds of entrepreneurs over the years, there are certainly personal characteristics that are necessary. And one of them, I think you just talked about it, is a kind of relentlessness. You know, if you're an entrepreneur, you have to be like the positive version of a shark. You know, you have to just keep going. And there's this need to be deeply resilient. But that's not to say that you have to be falsely positive. I see that the entrepreneurs that I know who are most successful are not only relentlessly committed and keep going and figuring out how to get past obstacles and how to make things work, they're also kind of relentlessly objective. They're really accurate about themselves, about conditions, about the market. Because if you are making stuff up about how well you're doing or about what the market needs or about whether your product has an audience, you're not helping yourself. So you have to be really objective.
Yeah. Be also a good listener as well, I think.
Yes.
To hear other people's input.
Yes.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
And I think some, you know, there's the leadership, like there's, you know, different people have different criteria to make a good leadership. And you wrote in your book, there's, you know, these are certain characteristics that you need to have to be a good leader. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. So one of the books I wrote, as you know, is called Leading So People Will Follow. And I came to this almost 25 years ago. I was 25 plus years ago. I had recently started my business, which I started in 1990. And at the time I had young kids and who are now grown-ups with kids of their own. But at the time they were young and I was reading them stories all the time, as one does. And I was two things were happening simultaneously. As I was starting to work with very senior leaders in organizations, I started to notice this phenomenon that I called accepted leader versus appointed leader. I noticed that some leaders, they had the job, they had the plaque on the door, you know, they were appointed, but they weren't, they didn't seem to be completely accepted by their, you know, followers as leaders. And then I would see other leaders who maybe didn't have the big job, but people really treated them as the leader. And one day, or in the early 90s, when this really became clear to me, I was standing in the back of the room when this guy who was, he was the head of a television network, he was talking to his top 20 people or so. And they were all listening, you know, nobody was running out of the room, they were all listening. But I noticed, and I was standing in the back so I could see this happen, that during the course of the 20 or so minutes that he talked, almost everyone in the room at some point looked at his CFO. And it was clear to me that they were more interested in how the CFO was hearing and reacting to what was being said than what was being said. And I thought, wow, appointed leader versus accepted leader, they're treating the CFO like he's the actual leader, right? And so I started to think about that more. And I thought, well, you know, it makes sense, because until a few hundred years ago, who we chose and allowed to be our leader was a life or death decision. You know, if you chose badly, you were more likely to starve or get killed by the invading whoever's, or right? And so I thought, well, may, it's so unconscious, but it's clearly not arbitrary, because almost everybody thinks this guy's the leader. What? That sounds like a survival mechanism. That sounds wired in. So I was going through this whole thought process while I was reading all these stories from all over the world to my kids. And I noticed that there is a story all over the world, in pretty much every culture that I could find, where there's a quest and somebody wins, somebody does what needs to be done, whether it's killing a dragon or rescuing the princess. And quite often it's three brothers, and the two eldest brothers fail spectacularly. And then the youngest one, who nobody has any faith in, you know, goes through all these trials and tribulations and kills the dragon and wins the princess and becomes the king. And we all live happily ever after. And as I was reading all these stories, which seemed timeless and cross-cultural, I noticed over and over again that there were very specific attributes that this kid who becomes the king had to demonstrate, or had to develop and then demonstrate, in order to succeed in the quest and become a king. And so I thought, oh, you know, stories are the DNA of preliterate societies. Maybe these stories are telling us what we need to look for in leaders in order to safely follow them, that these are followable leaders. So I extracted from these stories, and then I started to read them much more intentionally, six qualities that seemed to come up over and over again. And I tested them out on a leader who I was coaching, who I had a lot of faith in. And he was like, oh my gosh, that makes all the sense in the world. Here's what I'm good at. Here's what I'm, it really landed for him. So that was the beginning of the evolution of the book, which came out quite a bit later. So long story. So the six attributes that we found, and when we created the assessment, it turns out they really are highly correlated with followability. We had a statistician look at that. So they are farsighted, passionate, courageous, wise, generous, and trustworthy. So farsighted means can see and articulate in an inclusive way a future. A future for the organization, and then can gather people together and overcome obstacles to keep moving toward it, to achieve it. That's one thing that, you know, if you could, if you think about it historically, even would have been so important, and is still obviously important today. Passionate, people think it means loud or charismatic, but it actually means deep. Passionate means depth of commitment, that people want to look at their leaders and know that they're not going to be just distracted by the next shiny object, that they really, when they commit to something, that they're going to follow through. Not that they're not permeable. They also, part of passion is openness and permeability. You know, they take in new, what you said before about listening, but it's primarily depth of commitment. Courageous means first and last, being willing to do things that are difficult or uncomfortable for you for the good of the enterprise. And that includes being willing to apologize, being willing to, you know, acknowledge mistakes and move forward, being willing to stand up for important things, even when it's tough, you know, all those kinds of things. Wise means not just intelligence or knowledge, it's reflection upon those things. Wise means you reflect upon your experience and you see the pattern and you learn from it and you're willing to share that with other people. So to your earlier point about listening, listening is a huge part of wisdom. It's impossible to be wise unless you really take in a lot from a lot of different sources and then think what it means and then share your conclusions. Generous means primarily generosity of spirit. People want leaders who believe in them, who believe in their potential and support their success. And even in tough times, you know, when there's not money to share or promotions to share, still that generosity of spirit where you really believe in people and support them and help them move forward, critical. And the last one is trustworthy. People need leaders who do what they say they're going to do, who act with integrity, who tell the truth. So those are the six. And they're as important for leaders of startup companies as they are for leaders of, you know, companies that have 100,000 employees.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are, you know, it makes sense. And I can see people with that kind of quality is somebody that I would like to follow.
Exactly.
So what you're saying earlier, there's the appointed leader and then the accepted leader. And how the organization, do you think the organization picked the wrong person? Or is it because of certain personality that the appointed person rise up to become the leader when they are not the right leader?
Yes.
And how can we change that? Because that's not good for the organization.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So it's important that, and I've thought about this a lot, obviously, over the years, but it's important that people who are choosing leaders are choosing well. And it's interesting, what I've noticed is that, and what we saw when we were creating the multi-rater assessment, is that, and I think this is wonderful, that these qualities are no more or less common in men, in women, in people of color, in young people, and old people. These qualities have a wonderful diversity and inclusiveness. And I think that if people who are choosing leaders are really choosing based on how well these people have led, can lead, how they build consensus, how they, you know, all these things, whether they're farsighted, passionate, courageous, rather than, I think still people pick leaders based on, are they white? Are they male? Are they, you know, do the other white male people support their success, you know? And so I feel like it's all a part of people choosing based on real criteria that are not about race or gender or ethnicity, you know, but real criteria, real leader criteria.
Right. And I think, you know, I'm just making this observation, could be a wrong observation as well, is that oftentimes, at least in the society, is a cultural too as well, that somebody who is charismatic, who somehow looks like they're likable and they somehow can say the right jokes, and they're opinionated enough that they're loud, so it sounds like they are competent, they tend to shine versus somebody who can be the listener, the quiet one, and pay attention to the detail. They can be, people don't notice them. It's always like, it's hard to notice somebody when they just walk, when the other person is jumping on the trampoline, right? And how do you train that?
I think that's exactly right. And there is a lot of research that shows that. There's some wonderful books written. I can't remember her name at the moment, but there's a woman who wrote wonderful books about introverts and about exactly what you're saying, that introverts are underestimated in our society. And I think there's both a from the outside in and from the inside out. I think people who are who don't have those kind of loud, hail fellow, well-met kind of qualities that people look to and go, oh, that guy would be a great leader. I think people who are quieter, more introverted, more thoughtful, they need to make sure they have a good variety of tools in their interpersonal toolkit that they can come forward when they need to, that they can, take control in a room when they need to, just to have it as a tool so they're not limited. Just as I feel like the louder people have to have it in their toolkit to be quiet and to listen, and to, right? I wrote a blog post on my Forbes blog a number of years ago based on this great article that it was about salespeople, but it completely supported what we're saying now. It said that, you know, people think extroverts make better salespeople than versus introverts, but that the research shows that the best salespeople are what this author called ambiverts, meaning people who could shift depending on the circumstances, depending on who they were talking to, depending on the situation. If they were with somebody who was more extroverted, they could be more extroverted. If they were with somebody who was more introverted, they could be quieter and more, you know, receptive. And I just thought that was fascinating. So it's about versatility. It's about flexibility, right? So that's internally. And externally, mm-hmm. I think it goes back to what I was just saying before, that we have to, and what we were saying at the very beginning of the conversation, we just need to challenge our assumptions. So if you find yourself, for instance, as a hiring manager, always hiring those loud, happy, quote unquote, charismatic people, you know, note what you're saying to yourself. And if you're saying to yourself, oh, those people make the best leaders, just go, is that accurate? Do I have facts mm-hmm. to support that? And then if you investigate, you'll probably find out that's not true, right?
Yeah. And I think there's also at least some people perceive that the leaders are the people who are the manager, who are the CEO, but you know, every individual contributor, they can also be a leader. And I think that's a quality that people need to look for when they hire anybody, not just somebody who, you know, if you hire somebody at the entry level, that person should be a follower. I don't think that is the right way of hiring.
I think that's right, both follower and leader. I mean, you have to hire people who are good at being part of a team, but also people who have those leader qualities. I really agree. And, you know, it's funny, more and more companies now are creating what have come to be called core values. Like, here are the four or five things. And I noticed over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, a lot of those values are about ownership or being entrepreneurial or things like that. And what they mean is that is exactly what you're saying, that they people are starting to see that it's important for everyone in an organization, even entry-level people, to be able to see themselves as responsible, as leaders, as owners. And I completely agree with that. I think in organizations where everyone has that sense of, I'm an important part of this organization and what I do and say is influential, that's positive. And then they need to be treated that way by the organization, or it just becomes demoralizing and loses credibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So going back, so, you know, we support a lot of early stage entrepreneurs, and oftentimes, you know, they're founders, they have the ideas that they want to bring it to the finish line. And all these six characters that you mentioned, the farsighted, passionate, courageous, wise, generous, and trustworthy.
Yeah.
Not, you know, some people, is it something that they were raised that way? If they're not, you know, I think everybody is, they would say they were raised that way, but I think certain circumstances make them yes. not like that. Yeah. How can they change? How, you know, is there like a tool for them that when they don't quite get there?
Yes. I mean, that's why I wrote the book. It's so funny when the book came out 9 years ago, I think. And as I was doing interviews for the book, people would ask that question, well, aren't leaders born? And I would think, I probably wouldn't have written this book if I didn't think people could improve, right? And so in the book, I go through, we've taken each of the six characteristics, and over the years, as we observed and coached and worked with people, we pulled out five behavioral indicators for each one of the six that, so you can see more clearly what it looks like, you know, because you can say farsighted, oh, that's big. Well, what does that look like? Well, can envision futures that are good for the business, can articulate them in a compelling way. You know, it's, we picked out those five behaviors. So that's helpful. And then in the book, for each one of the five behaviors, I say, okay, so if you think this is a soft spot for you, here's what you can do to strengthen in that area. And of course, again, back to the beginning of our conversation, it requires accurate self-assessment. You have to be able to be accurate about where you're starting from so you know what you need to work on.
And I think having coach sometimes help you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Dial in your self-assessment.
Yes, absolutely. And we use our multi-rater assessment and the conversation with the coach a lot, especially for new leaders. We call it the accepted leader assessment, and now you know why, to help people get a sense of how they're seen. And so their coach can then help them to improve in the areas where they need improvement.
So can we pick, let's pick being generous as one of the weakness. What are the five steps to improve your generosity?
Okay, I'm not sure I have them in my brain, but the five behavioral elements of generosity, the first one, or an important one, is to assume positive intent. So people who are generous, they start out assuming that people are good, are trying to do their best, or that may not be true, but that's an important assumption to start with. And again, that lives in self-talk. Like there was one woman that I coached many years ago, and that was her biggest Achilles heel, is that she did not assume positive intent with people. So I started out by having her just observe the impact of that. And what she realized is because she was not generally assuming positive intent, it made it so that her people came to her, especially when there was a problem, in a kind of pre-defensive, self-protective way. And that was how the conversation started. And as soon as she saw that, she thought, wow, I'm making that happen by my negative assumptions. So she really worked on literally changing her self-talk so that when, before people came into her to have a meeting, especially if she knew there was a problem, she'd say to herself, I truly believe that they're trying to do their best in their situation. And that really helped because then the person didn't feel fearful, didn't feel as much like they were going to get, you know, knocked around. And it created much better conversations and therefore much better outcomes. So a lot of it comes back to just observing how your current behavior is impacting people and then changing either how you talk to yourself about it or how you literally react.
It's interesting you mentioned that because when you're in a startup or, you know, when you're still, you know, paving your way, you do a lot of experimentation. Like you try new things, right? And when you try a new thing, you make a mistake. And if you don't have that generosity to the team, everybody is afraid to try a new thing.
I totally agree.
And so I like that it's all about telling yourself. It's easier said than done, right? Because I think that person, the nature of that person is assuming negative.
Yes. You know,
and how does he undo that?
Yeah. It really requires discipline to notice and change what you're saying to yourself. Sometimes when I'm working with people who have some unhelpful and unsupportive self-talk loops, I encourage them to either do it on their phone or literally get a little notebook. And when they find themselves either feeling in a negative way, like feeling anxious or angry or sad or overwhelmed, write down what they're saying to themselves. And if it's not helpful, not accurate, not supportive, just change it right there. Just say, no, what I want to say to myself is this, I bet this person thinks this is the right outcome, versus maybe they're saying to themselves, this person's always trying to make my life difficult. It's like, wow, no, I don't think that's true. I think this person thinks they're doing the best thing, you know? So write yourself an alternative and then say it to yourself in those situations.
I think help writing is so helpful, because oftentimes when we do this sort of soft skill exercise, we just think that, oh, I just, you know, it's not math. I don't need to write it out, all this calculus equation. But writing out your thought, it stares back at you. That's for you to realize.
Yes, stares back at you. That's exactly right. It's sort of like, you know, when you cut your hair and then you see it, it doesn't belong to you anymore. When you write it down, it gives you this very different perspective. When it's just happening inside your head, it feels immutable. It feels like, oh, this is just part of me. When you write it down, because I do this myself. I try and keep my own caviar in this regard. And I do this myself. And sometimes I'll write things down and I'll think, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm actually, that's ridiculous, or that's wrong, or I don't believe that. Here's what I actually believe. And then I write down my alternative, you know?
Right. So I think, you know, I'm continuing the you know, assuming the negative intention or assuming the positive intention. How do you also, and as a leader, sometimes you have a team member who tend to be negative, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's the Eeyore and then there's the Tigger. And
right. There's
always, we always have the Eeyore and the Tigger in our team,
right?
Because everything is relative. And, you know, you need both of them sometimes, because I think, but I think sometimes the Eeyore needs to think more positive and the Tigger needs to think more realistic about things. And is this method that what you're saying is like, how can you convince somebody who, you know, who has not come out saying like, this is what I need to improve, but you tell them that this is an area they need to improve? It requires self-discipline and, you know, you really have to want to do it. How do you convince that person, this is what we want you to do, that you need to do it in order to be better, when they have not realized that?
Yeah. So many levels to that answer. First, one of the things that's absolutely critical for leaders is to be able to give constructive feedback well.
Right.
And we could do a whole podcast about that. But one of the critical things in giving feedback well is to be able to give it in a way that is behavioral. Because often we give feedback in ways that are very judgmental and interpretive. Like, for instance, and impossible for the other person to act on. Like, for instance, in your Eeyore and Tigger example, we literally say to people, you're kind of an Eeyore. You got to stop doing that. They're like, I don't have.
What does that mean, right?
What does that mean? How do I possibly do that? So then you have to figure out how to say it like it's a videotape that you're commenting on. Like, for instance, you might say, so and so, I noticed that quite often when someone says a new idea, your first response is how it won't work or how it's going to be difficult. Now, that is still not a walk in the park to hear, but you know exactly what you're doing that's not working, right? So, and I think that's really important for leaders to understand how to give that really neutral behavioral feedback, because then you can help people figure out what to do about it. And you can teach them exactly what we've been talking about, how to see and assess and question your own self-talk and then change it.
Mm-hmm. It's a changing behavior. It's such an interesting.
Yeah. The other thing that's really important is, and this comes out of the book that I've just finished that I'm very excited about, it's coming out in October. It's called Change from the Inside Out. And the core of the book is how individual people go through change and then how can you cascade that through a whole organization. And what we discovered is that when a person really makes a change is when their mindset, and we've been talking so much about mindset, when their mindset about the change can shift from this is going to be difficult and costly and weird, you know, meaning hard to do, I don't know how to do it, I'm not going to get support for doing it. Costly means it's going to cost me not only time and money, but identity and reputation and relationship. It's going to be, you know, it's going to cost me things I value. And it's just going to be weird. It doesn't feel right. shifting from that to, oh, this new way of behaving, this change, could be easy, rewarding, and normal. So as a manager, as a leader, as an entrepreneur, if you're trying to get people to change their behaviors, you have to figure out how to help them shift their mindset around that new behavior from difficult, costly, weird to easy, rewarding, normal. So part of, in your example, getting the EOR to think in more positive ways, making it easier is teaching them how to do it, just like we've talked about. Making it more rewarding is very individual. You have to tap into their motivational system and, huh, what would be rewarding for them? Maybe they feel like they don't have enough influence. And if they start out by looking at things sometimes in a more positive light, that would certainly help them to be more influential. Okay, I can let them know that. That would be rewarding for them. And normal is a lot about what other people do. So if they see me doing it, hopefully they admire me, they like me, they want to be like me. Maybe they see other peers doing it who they admire. You know, the more you can normalize that in the environment, the easier it is for them to do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, that's great. Well, Erica, thank you so much for your time and sharing with us your insight, what you learned through your experience working with all your clients.
Oh, you're so welcome. And you asked such wonderful questions. This has just been a delight.
Yeah, no, I think it's really, you know, being a leader is a growing process, right? It's
absolutely
constantly learning. And everybody can be one.
Yes, absolutely. And one of my favorite quotes, and I use this all the time and in various books, is supposedly Michelangelo, when people would give him compliments, he would say in Italian, "Ancora imparo," which means "I am still learning." And that is supposedly his favorite thing to say. So if that's okay for arguably the greatest artist in Western history, that, you know, it's probably good for us.
That's true. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
Yes.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Netto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.